This is work I've been doing with Lars for the last couple of months. I'll keep it short, so I'll just focus on a small part of it. So one theme that's sort of emerged during the conference so far is that melting is a central process in much of the science. You need it to do all kinds of interesting things with it, with your, like, differentiated chemically. Melting can occur at various places, B double prime, above, and maybe even below the oxygen zone, and then of course at the surface. And an understanding of melts and their properties is also important for our understanding of the processes that occur during the early Earth and how it sort of evolves into something solid as opposed to a magma ocean. So our idea is to get at the properties of the liquids at high pressures and temperatures from a computational angle where we calculate them at a given pressure and temperature. So the method we use is density functional theory, and specifically first principles molecular dynamics, which is different from classical molecular dynamics where you specify the interatomic forces by a pre-specified potential function, which is sort of a, if I can draw something, this is shaped like that Lars and everybody showed it. Anyway, it's something like that, and it has a minimum, and the shape, if you take the derivative of that, essentially you get the force. This is not what we do. Is we use density functional theory, where you calculate the electronic structure of the material, and from that, you get the forces. So, showing here, this is WASDI. I'm just sort of showing this as an example of what it would, if you could conceptualize what it looks like. So there's the red spheres are oxygens, the green balls are silicons, and then those are magnesiums. And the contours, so these colors, forget about the gray for now, the blue background and then the red and green over there, those are contours of charge density. And then the actual gray surfaces are isosurfaces, so it's a specific value sort of extrapolated into 3D. What's interesting to note is the directionality on these oxygens that are bound to silicon. See that it's not a sphere, it points towards the silicon. And there's two points on this bridging oxygen, the covalent nature of this last bond versus that being a sphere, that oxygen is not bound to silicon. That's the underbound oxygen that Lars is referring to. And you can see it's nice and spherical. So another thing that's just more trivial in terms of density functional theory is it was invented by these three guys, Kahn, Chan, and Honenberg. And Walter Kahn is actually an emeritus professor here at UCB, and he won the Nobel Prize in 1998. I found this on the internet. I think it was on one of the poles outside on the ocean road. Okay. So a little bit more detail about the actual calculations. I'll focus in this study on specifically porphyrite composition, but molten, so it doesn't have the actual porphyrite crystal structure. We do the calculations in the canonical ensemble, so it's constant volume and temperature, where normally molecular dynamics are done in the microcanonical ensemble, so constant internal energy instead of temperature. And the way you get around that is by adding a heat bath. So this red line would be the energy of the system and the heat bath. That stays constant. So essentially, in the end, you're still in the microcanonical ensemble, but your actual system, the energy varies so that we can keep the temperature constant. So we did this for our system as 112 atoms, so it's 16 MT2SO4 units. And for a number of volumes, so 1.0 would be the actual volume at the surface, the experimentally measured volume at 0 GPa at the melting temperature. And then for values, that is progressively less than that up to half of it. And then so we heat it up, we melt it at 6,000 Kelvin, and then cool it isochorically to 3,000 and 4,000 Kelvin. So for each of these volumes, we'd have three runs. And each of those runs is run for at least 3,000 time steps, where one time step is a femtosecond. And we throw away the first 600 time steps, so from there back. Because that's where the system converges. So beyond that, if you look at this is pressure as a function of time. And the blue line is the sort of a walking mean, if you want. So the black line, the big wiggles, are the actual values. But the mean approaches the final mean. And the green is the standard deviation. You can see there about 600, it starts meeting the reference. That's not very exciting. Some of the runs we run for longer to try and get the errors down and just see that it doesn't actually depend on science scale and things like that. Okay, so I'm going to show you a movie of one of these runs just to give you a better concept of what it actually looks like. So this is a snapshot from this movie. The specific movie is for this run. It's not quite a zero Kelvin because it's higher temperature than the melting point. But it is the same, it's the experimental volume, and then 50,000 Kelvin for the full 3 picoseconds. And just for scale, this edge, so it's a cube, and this edge of the box is about 11 angstrom. So a couple of things to note. There are more oxygen, so all these red spheres are oxygen, but there are more oxygen in here than just those red spheres, because the red spheres are oxygens that are not bound to silicon, right? But every silicon has some number of oxygens around it, so that's what these polyhedra are. It's either a tetrahedron or some pyramid or octahedron or even a triangle like that. So all of those are different coordination polyhedra of silicon. And then the yellow spheres are magnesium atoms. Another thing to note is there's some degree of polymerization. For example, these two. So I think this is an octahedron, difficult to see into the ball bearing. Those two are linked. So there's some degree of polymerization. And another thing just to keep in mind, you'll see stuff flashing in and flashing out, is there's a periodic boundary condition in these calculations. So that is the same thing as that, it's the same thing as that, it's the same thing as that. Right? So it repeats itself. Is that everything? Yeah. Okay, right. I guess I'll show you. So this is a bit. I can't see on my computer. So, here it is. If you keep your eye on, for example, there's two edge sharing polyhedra instead of face sharing polyhedra. There's a nice chain forming. You see, things are moving around, very dynamic. Bonds are breaking and reforming and breaking and reforming. Some bonds break and the same bond will reform, but some slowly through time, you just stare at this for a day, you'll start seeing, or if you stare at all of them for a day, you start seeing polyhedra walking around, sort of making their way across the box. Yeah, it's very educational to watch this. And some, you know, when you start seeing really interesting things, like for example, when two polyhedra start sharing an edge, it'll warp because the silicons move away from each other. It's falling through. Very, very, very interesting to watch. Okay.
So the oxygen is actually being lost when they go off.
No, it goes out there and it comes back in here.
Or it just makes it large.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not. It's not a large displacement. It's just. I mean, that is the same oxygen as that. So it just. And actually, the periodic boundary condition is something you have to keep in mind when you do these calculations, because a liquid is not supposed to have any periodicity in it. So you have to account for that when you do the calculation. So it limits how small you can make the box.
Will this model actually crystallize force rate?
It will not crystallize. If you cool this down to, say, 1,000 Kelvin, it will not crystallize force rate. But if you take a force rate crystal, or the crystalline structure, and you put it next to the liquid, and you run them together first at 3,000 Kelvin, and then you cool it down to 1,000 Kelvin, this will crystallize into. So if you seed it, it'll crystallize. That's actually a way that you can calculate the melting curve, and that we're working on that. That's sort of part of what we're working on. Is you let them coexist, but you have to get them into equilibrium before you actually run them together. So you fix the one, and then you fix the other, and it's fun. Okay, getting back to. Okay. So if you do that for all kinds of volumes and temperatures, so shown here are three curves. This is the equation of state. So this is volume, then fractional volume, and pressure in GPA. The blue curve is 3,000 Kelvin, then green is 4,000, and then red would be 6,000 Kelvin. And you fit to this the Birch-Minogan equation of state. And so that would be the green of the blue curve. And by fitting a straight line to these points, and they are on a straight line. It's not as if it's a weird fit. It doesn't show very well here, but it's a linear fit to these points if you fit them in T space, right? So that gives you this term, or alpha KT. So that's what these values are. You can generate a very nice smooth equation of state. So a smooth equation of state in general would indicate to you that there are no discontinuities occurring. So if there was a step in it, then there's a structural change or something. Now, of course, there's no way we would represent a step very easily right there, but there, it would be very difficult to fit the equation of state if there was a step in it. So the change of pressure with temperature increases with as you decrease the volume. And that is weird. That is unusual. If you look at any equation of state for a crystalline substance, the isotherms converge. And here they diverge. If you look at the distance between those points and up there, that distance is much bigger than this, right? That is rather surprising. And if you think about it in a little bit more detail, looking at that line, this blue line has a smaller slope than the red line, and the slope of this line is the bulk modulus. So at higher temperature, the liquid is less compressible, which is counterintuitive if you think in terms of solids. So obviously one would like to explain why this happens. Some other thermodynamic properties that you can derive in a similar way, this is the isochoric heat capacity, so the constant volume. Shown here at the bottom is the classical 3R limit, the Von-Petit limit that you would have for a crystalline substance. So it's higher than that, which makes sense, it's a liquid, but it decreases, right? In the mantle, if you were to look at the capacity with pressure, this will generally stay constant unless there's other contributions to the entropy, like electronic effects or something like that. And then just there, shown for reference, is an experimental value of the capacity. So the alpha KT values, which I've showed on the previous figure, and then the heat capacity values, conspire together to give you an increase in Grunheisen parameter, which, again, is weird because for crystals, an isostructural compression, Grunheisen parameter will decrease. But it does increase when you go across a phase transition where the silicon coordination changes. So say from 4 to 6 fold coordination, as you would have when you go from, say, majorite to perovskite. And actually, if you plot the values for those phases on here, even though they don't have quite the same composition, they do follow this curve. So that suggests to us that there's something in the structure that is causing this interesting behavior. So how does the structure change with pressure and temperature? So this is the run you were looking at earlier in the movie. All of these are 3,000 Kelvin, and you step through the different compressions to half this volume. And a couple of things are interesting to note. One is this structure is very open, generally free-floating tetrahedra. There's quite a lot of these free oxygens. There's not much in terms of polymerization. There's two are linked, and there's a little bit of stuff going on there. But if you contrast that through up to here, now I don't actually see any tetrahedron in there. They're all octahedra, mostly. Well, they're all linked. Some of them even share edges. For example, there's a threefold coordinated oxygen, so it's bound to three silicons, not just two, as would be the case in a bridging oxygen like that. So in general, it seems that the polymerization increases, the number of free oxygens goes down, and the coordination number increases. So if you place that in a little bit more of a quantitative sense, so shown here is again volume, fractional volume, and then this is the coordination number of silicon and magnesium, and the bond lengths from silicon to oxygen and magnesium to oxygen. And you see the silicon-oxygen coordination basically changes continuously, and if you really squint, you can say it's linearly as a function of volume, from four-fold coordination up to six-fold coordination. And it actually, I have a plate with points beyond that, and it keeps going. But I don't want to get into that now. What's interesting on top of this is the fact that the bond length, atoms don't actually get closer together. The bond length, if you follow the blue dots, they the bonding between silicon and oxygen gets bigger. And that's purely as a result of this increase in the coordination number. And then finally, here, this is about, I think, 40 GPa. It starts dipping back down to that value. If you take the numerical value, it's still bigger than this value. So another thing to note is the temperature dependence. Except for there seems to be a general strong temperature dependence in these structures. So let's look at the temperature dependence in a little bit more detail, but also at the polymerization. And these plots are, I've been trying to figure out a way to explain them to people, that they're a little hairy. They're pretty. So on the left is 3,000 Kelvin, and then on the right is the same 6,000 Kelvin, and this is on the x-axis would be, again, the fractional volume. What this essentially shows is that at any that distance, say, would be the fraction of silicons of a specific species. So in this case, so there are these, you can see there are these zones. So this is a four-fold fluorinated zone, a five-fold, six-fold, actually seven-fold is up there, that's the three. You can see it better here, there's three, two is down there, there's seven and eight, right? And it cycles through from purple to red, and then purple to red, and that keeps going. So the basic idea is purple would be none of the oxygens are bridging, so it's the polyhedron is completely free floating. It's not bound to any other polyhedra. And then the red would be the exact opposite of that. All the corners are bound to other polyhedra. So if we look at the pressure effect first, right? Just looking at this plot, there's no purple down there, right? So in general, they are more, the melts are more polymerized at higher pressure. And lower pressure. And that's what we saw in that structure. So there's far more red and orange over here than there is over here. You can see that even better at the higher temperature point, where you can see more red over there. But what's interesting though is at the higher temperature, there's red there and there's red there, and there's far less of the purple. So at higher temperature, the lower pressure points are more polymerized. Right? There's more red on the higher pressure side, and that, if you think about how materials compress and the cause of seismic anisotropy, something would be most compressible in the direction where the silicons are not linked, right? So you essentially, as you increase the temperature, you form more of a framework of silicon atoms, and that's what gives you the increase in the bulk modulus, the temperature. Okay, so just to summarize that, the bulk modulus increases with temperature if at constant volume. That's an important point to keep in mind, because experimentalists tend to think in terms of constant pressure and temperature. The heat capacity of the melts decreases with pressure, and that conspires to give you an increasing Grignard parameter, which would then increase, which would then influence the actual adiabatic profile that you calculate if you have a whole molten planet. So just mentioning other things we've been looking at, and specifically the influence of the structure on these properties, would be the fissility, the electronic structure that you get when you mix various liquids, and how that compares to our calculations. So mixing various calculations of various liquids. And then with Minak, who was here until last week, we were also looking at the effect of water and the water structure. Thank you.
Think back to Stanford. Did you observe all the crystal structure change to liquid structure?
Yeah, the 6,000 Kelvin, what we do is we take force strike, and you strain it a little into a cube, that's why I have 112 atoms. If you pack four force strike unit cells you get very close to a cube. So you strain it slightly, and you heat it up to 6,000 Kelvin, and it melts very quickly, within about 50 or 100 time steps. Including ironing in these calculations is not trivial.
I know. That's the...
Yeah. See, the thing is, if you want to correct for U, the U term, you have to... So U is a... it's a correction, because iron has so many electrons, it's a correction for the interaction of electrons with each other on the same atom. And calculating that, you actually need to know the surrounding structure of the ion. So you would have to recalculate the U term every single time step, and calculating the U term itself is not a trivial endeavor.
So you cannot model
I don't think so. I mean, I'm sure you can. The other problem is the calculations of the plus U term is not necessarily 100% accurate. So I think we would have to give it a couple of more years before we can do that. But that's definitely a goal, because iron goes into the melt whenever anything melts. It's very important to keep in mind. No, I don't think you should think of it in terms of anisotropy, because there's no preferred orientation in the liquid. All I'm saying is I'm comparing it to why you have anisotropy in solids. So why you have a fast direction versus a slow direction, and the fact that you have a network, more of a network at higher temperatures, gives you a higher bulk modulus. That's all I'm saying. Yeah.
Well, if you're seeing the application of this model for looking at diffusivity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Could you look at like a noble gas with a very simple electron structure like helium?
You can do that, but I would say there are other methods that are more accurate if you wanted to get. So if you wanted to get self-diffusivity, this is fine. If you wanted to get the diffusivity of a defect, then this is not fine, because you have a periodic boundary condition. But what you can do, and actually would be more accurate, is to calculate the actual, if you want to call it, the activation energy, so the hump of energy over which it needs to get, just map that out, and there are standard methods to do that. Yeah. But so, in general, and you'll still be using the functional theory, just not molecular dynamics at all.